beauty of the day. A million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill-offs gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we come marching, marching.
Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
I think that in the future, people will look back at Jack Welch the way we look back at somebody like J.P. Morgan 100 years or more ago, as sort of symbolic of the nature of an era, including its excesses and including what that era meant for most working families.
That's labor historian Joe McCartan, who talks with Labor History Today's Patrick Dixon this week about Jack Welch, the former CEO of General Electric, who died last week at the age of 84. Also this week, Sherry Lincoln takes a look at the class conflict in two recent award-winning movies, Joker and Parasite.
Both films reflect the recent interest in and anxiety about working-class resentment. The two films reveal how economic inequality translates into cultural conflict.
I think you're going to really enjoy both of these. Here's the show.
As we go marching, marching, we're standing proud and tall. The rising of the women means the rising of us all. No more the drudge and idler, tend that toil where one reposes, but the sharing of life's glories, bread and roses. Bread and roses.
We grade people on the bottom 10, middle 70, and top 20. And we do it every single year. We do it rigorously. Now, people can move from the middle 70 to the top 20, and from the top 20 down to the middle 70.
That was Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, who died last Sunday at the age of 84. A chemical engineer before he moved into management at GE, Welch has come to be seen as one of the defining business leaders of the late 20th century, celebrated on Wall Street, but ridiculed further afield. Patrick Dixon spoke to labor historian Joe McCartan about Welch's influence at GE and how he changed the way in which American corporations approached their workforces.
So I first encountered Jack Welch when I came here in the early 2000s. When I'd go into a bookstore, I'd see Jack Welch's books as guides to business. He'd have this broad, self-satisfied grin on the front cover, and he was portrayed as something of a guru. I know you talk about him often in your labor history classes at a certain point in time. Why do you think he's significant?
Well, Jack Welch, in a lot of ways, was the prototypical capitalist of the late 20th century era, which is a time not very good for workers at all. He was known as Neutron Jack during his years at GE. And that was because, like the neutron bomb, whatever Jack touched, it seemed, wiped out people, left buildings standing, but wiped out the people. And that's certainly what happened during his tenure at GE. He began at GE the same year that Ronald Reagan, he began as CEO, that is, the same year, and he'd worked there for many years before that, but he became CEO in 1981, the same year that Ronald Reagan broke the air traffic controllers. So he took the reins of one of the most prestigious and largest American corporations at a time when workers were in retreat, when unions were in retreat, and when capitalism was really undergoing some remarkable changes on Wall Street and in corporate America. The 1970s had seen the era of the leverage buyout and the rise of private equity firms and rise to an almost religious kind of status of the idea of maximizing shareholder value. And that became Jack Welch's mantra at GE. It was all about the stock price of the company. And the moves that he made were about jacking up that price. And his annual compensation, like that of other CEOs, was usually closely tied to that because a lot of it came in stock options. And so Welch drove transformation at GE, and he influenced what corporate America was doing in general in the 80s and 90s. They were cutting back on people, they were reorganizing their businesses, and they were doing almost all of that to jack up stock prices. He became the model businessman. It was not for nothing that he was the person that 50 Rock, the TV sitcom, cited as the sort of inspiration for the CEO on that particular program. And he became probably the best known and most influential CEO of those years.
So he sold a lot of books, but I feel like the past decade, at least since the financial crash of 2008, he became considered perhaps a bit more of an unfashionable figure. Why do you think that was? Was it not possible for someone to be quite so brazen in their disregard for workers and in their approach to outsourcing?
Well, in the age of Occupy Wall Street and in the aftermath of the Great Recession, what Jack Welch had represented at the turn of the 21st century was somewhat called into disrepute. It was some of that same kind of corporate buccaneering, you might say, that had helped to set the stage for the meltdown of 2008. And I think that Welch, in the aftermath of the Great Recession, was seen as somebody from that earlier period. He was not nearly as influential as he'd once been. He was more of a parody of himself, hence his role on things like 50 Rock. He wasn't nearly as revered a figure, but he still made his presence known. And in 2012, he was constantly attacking Obama. And arguing even that the jobs numbers that Obama's Labor Department or Bureau of Labor Statistics were releasing were fake, fixed to try to help engineer Obama's election. He was outspoken against the very idea that there is a climate crisis and global warming. And he called it basically like Donald Trump has done, a kind of a hoax. So he became a more marginal figure. But he still liked to rattle his sword into recent years, and he was passing on his way of thinking through things like Strayer University, the online university in which they offered an online degree at the Jack Welch, I think, Management Institute it was called. I think that in the future, people will look back at Jack Welch the way we look back at somebody like J.P. Morgan 100 years or more ago, as sort of symbolic of the nature of an era, including its excesses and including what that era meant for most working families. Jack Welch presided over an era that saw economic concentration and inequality grow to new heights.
Here's Sherry Lincoln with a commentary on how class conflict plays out in two recent award-winning movies. It's based on the post she and John Russo published last week on the Working Class Perspectives blog.
A couple of weeks after the South Korean film Parasite won both Best Foreign Film and Best Picture, Donald Trump went on what the Washington Post called a nationalistic cultural rant about the film's awards. He was upset that a movie made in Asia, in Korean, was named the best film in the U.S. The Democratic National Committee responded by pointing out that Parasite revealed how oblivious the ultra-rich are about the struggles of the working class, a jab at Trump's supposed populism. The DNC also noted that watching it would have required Trump to read subtitles for 2 hours, a point the film's distributor echoed, tweeting that this was understandable because the president can't read. Trump's response might have been intended to encourage xenophobia among his base, but but it also reflects an important theme of Parasite that most reviews have ignored, elite anxiety about the working class. That anxiety has surfaced in the many studies and reports over the last decade that have tried to make sense of the seemingly exotic, incomprehensible working class of middle America. Scholars and journalists have spent time in working class communities, interviewed hundreds of working class people, and reviewed studies by experts about how economics, politics, and social patterns influence each other. They've produced dozens of books and articles, and readers have embraced these works, seeking to understand the working class, whose life experiences and worldviews seem so foreign. But along with their curiosity, many in the elite also view working class people with contempt and even fear. They worry about the political and social changes that seem to be rooted in working class resentment. Brexit threatens the British economy, and Trumpism seems to be destroying American democracy. White supremacists have killed more than 24 people, most of them Black or Latinx, in shootings in malls or houses of worship. Where did all this working class resentment come from? Both Parasite and Joker, another award-winning 2019 film, reflect those anxieties. Joker shows how a lifetime of abuse and disdain transforms a vulnerable working class boy into a gleeful incarnation of evil whose followers take to the streets, setting fires and rioting in clown masks. In Parasite, a working class family's initially amusing insinuation into a wealthy family's household takes a turn to violence. Reviews of the two films have been decidedly different. Some critics were put off by Joker's gratuitous violence, while others dismissed it as no more than pernicious garbage, a miserabilist manifesto, or a descent into madness. Fans posting on sites like IMDb found the film more appealing. One described Joker as a film about how an average man, beset by mockery, bullying, neglect, and daily life pressures, can go mad. In contrast, reviewers described Parasite as a class warfare thriller, driven by a screenplay that is doggedly on point in its themes of class resentment and economic warfare. While Parasite takes on class more overtly, both films reflect the recent interest in and anxiety about working class resentment. The two films reveal how economic inequality translates into cultural conflict. In Joker, Arthur Fleck's madness is fueled by cuts to the public health system, so he can no longer afford the medications that keep his mental health problems in check, but also by the contempt of mainstream society, represented by a late-night TV show host who makes Arthur's truly awful attempt at stand-up comedy the butt of repeated jokes. At first, Arthur is excited by the attention from someone he idolizes, but by the time he appears on the TV show and admits to having committed an infamous murder, he fully understands that he is the object of disdain. The wealthy Thomas Wayne expresses that contempt explicitly earlier in the film, commenting that those of us who have made something of our lives look at those who haven't as nothing but clowns. Parasite offers its own view into the struggles of working class daily life without the overlay of mental illness. Early scenes show how the Kim family scrapes by in their sub-basement apartment on low-wage piecework, reduced to crouching next to the toilet to access public Wi-Fi. Their elite businessman boss insists that workers remain respectful and avoid crossing the line, and he complains that they smell like old radishes. While his disdain may be less nasty than Thomas Wayne's, both films make clear that the elite have no idea what workers' lives are like. Instead, they view the working class as inferior, unpleasant, and problematic. While these films make a point of showing us the world through working class eyes, they also highlight elite anxiety about class. The clown agency where Arthur Fleck works seems innocent enough early in Joker, but after he kills three stockbrokers on the subway, that mask takes on a more sinister meaning. Once masked, workers all look alike, a move that makes tangible the lack of attention to differences or individuality in the way employers often view the workforce. Workers' seemingly happy faces and the apparent acceptance of demeaning working conditions and low wages mask their anger and resentment. They wear masks that grin and lie, as Paul Laurence Dunbar wrote over a century ago in his powerful poem about how African Americans navigate white society. As professional middle-class readers encounter working-class stories, in books like Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn's Tightrope or Sarah Smarsh's Heartland, they're probably becoming ever more aware of how much struggle and anger lies behind the masks that workers put on. Bosses may view workers with contempt, but as Parasite suggests, the working class is much savvier about their bosses than the bosses are about them. They understand that it's easy for rich people to be nice because, as one character puts it, money works like an iron, smoothing out the creases of life. The bosses, however, are completely taken in by the working class family's performances of expertise. The wealthy couple complain about their newly hired chauffeur's body odor, but they don't question his credentials. And of course, they have never noticed the guy secretly living in their basement. These films reassure elite viewers that working class people are likely to take their anger out on each other, often before they take aim at those who look down on them. Both films feature violence among workers. Early in Joker, Arthur is beaten up by a group of black teenagers, young men who probably share his class position. His first act of violence is shooting the wealthy jerks on the subway, but he also murders two of his co-workers, men who have failed to demonstrate anything like class solidarity. For all of Parasite's attention to class conflict, its major conflict is among workers, pitting the first housekeeper and her husband against the family of interlopers. After a very brief gesture towards solidarity, as the two families trade pleas for mercy and understanding, their interactions turn violent. They battle for the limited power they can grasp in a house where neither truly reigns. Their conflict continues until one finally realizes that his real enemy is the head of the wealthy family. In a period marked by economic inequality and social divides, these films show both sides of the class war. By presenting working-class characters whose experiences seem extreme, either because of mental health or abject poverty, they invite viewers to empathize, but perhaps not identify, with the working class. By highlighting elite contempt for the working class, they reinforce F. Scott Fitzgerald's lesson that the rich are different from you and me. But they also make visible the anxieties that not only the very wealthy, but many in the professional middle class feel about the working class, a group whose experiences and views seem not only foreign, but potentially dangerous.
Well, it looks like it might be a hard road, but I'm gonna walk it with you. And I know you might have a heavy load, but I can carry some too.
I will lift you up when they push you down. I will raise my voice and stand my ground.
Well, it looks like it might be a hard road, but I'm gonna walk it with you. Well, it looks like it might be a long night, but I ain't.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. Hope you enjoyed it, and you can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. We hope you do. This week's music is by Songrise, a DC-based women's social justice a cappella group. It performed on last week's Labor Live at 5 on WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C. as part of Union City Radio's Labor programming on that station. You can hear the entire performance on our website at dclabor.org. Click on Union City Radio. As a special bonus this week, stick around after the credits for another song by Songrise. We're available for booking at your next picket line, rally, or wherever music is needed to inspire the fight for social change. Find out more at songrisedc.org. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozek, and Alan Weirdeck. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks so much for listening. Keep making history, and see you next time.
But I can carry some too.
I will lift you up
when they push you down.
I will raise my voice
and stand my ground. Well, it looks like it might be a hard road, but I'm gonna walk it with you.
I will walk, I will climb, shine my light the whole night through,
because it looks like it might be a hard road, but I'm gonna walk it with you, that's right.
Oh, I'm gonna walk it with you.
Oh.
gonna walk it with you. I'm gonna walk it with you. Woke up this morning with my mind. Stayed on freedom. No, I woke up this morning with my mind. And it was stayed on freedom. You know, I woke up this morning with my mind.
That it was
stayed on freedom.
Hallelujah.
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 Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Walking and talking with my
mind.
Stayed on freedom. You see, I'm walking and talking with my mind.
No, I keep
stayed on freedom. You see, I'm walking and talking with my mind. Stayed on freedom. Hallelujah.
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 Darling,
walk, walk,
sugar,
walk, walk, with your mind on freedom, walk, walk,
darling,
walk, walk,
sugar,
walk, walk, with your mind on freedom, oh, come on and walk, walk,
come on
and walk,
talk, ooh, darling,
with your mind on freedom, talk, talk,
darling,
talk,
sugar,
talk, talk, with your mind on freedom, oh, hallelujah.
Now there ain't no harm in keeping your mind,
keeping it stayed,
stayed on freedom. No, there ain't no harm in keeping your mind,
keeping it
stayed on freedom. You know there ain't no harm in keeping your mind.